This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Urban Political, in which we're going to talk about the urban politics of density in and beyond the pandemic. Today, we welcome five guests from different time zones, and we're really happy to have you on board today. We also have a moderator for today's podcast, Colin McFarlane, and four speakers. I'm going to briefly introduce them to you. The moderator, Colin McFarlane, is a professor of urban geography at Durham University in the UK. His work focuses on the politics of urban life, particularly in relation to density, infrastructure, and equality. Hongying Chen is a postdoctoral research associate at Durham University in the UK. Trained as an urban planner and urban economic geographer, she's researching the political and cultural economy of land value capture and the sensorial geographies of urban density and precarious politics. Lucia Serrada Morato is the High Density Development Project Manager at Tower Hamlets Council in London. Trained as an architect and urban designer, she's currently completing a PhD at the Bartlett School of Planning in London. Margot Rubin is an associate professor at Wits University in South Africa and works at the NRF Research in Spatial Analysis and City Planning and the School of Architecture and Planning. She is also a research associate at the Southern Center for Inequality Studies. And last but not least, Roger Kyle is a professor at the Faculty of Environmental Studies at York University in Toronto. He researches global suburbanization, urban political ecology, cities and infectious disease, and regional governance. And with this brief introduction, I am happy to hand it over to Colin McFarlane as the moderator. And Colin, we're very happy to have you again with us about 1 year after our last episode on blaming density. And we really look forward to this discussion.
Excellent. Thank you, Marcus. And thank you, Ross, as well, for organizing this today. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to start, as Marcus was saying, by saying a few words by way of introduction to the topic, and then we can get going. So density, as we all know, is a fundamental question in the city. As ask someone to define a city, and the chances are that density will feature somewhere fairly quickly in the answer. In a certain sense, density is what cities are for. Cities compress people, things, goods, money, and information together. Cities are, in a certain sense, densifications. The histories of urban thinking, policy, and politics have also been histories of managing, counting, regulating, and shuffling densities. The history of density has also been a history of violence, of demolition and displacement, of projects that reorganize the urban fabric and destroy some densities and sometimes bring new ones into being. Density is inseparable from capitalist urbanization and its processes of creative destruction, and it's as much about class, race, gender, and other social vectors as it is about abstract numbers. Even before the pandemic, there was a lot of debate about density globally. Density was positioned by all kinds of voices as a solution to all kinds of problems. Cities looking to respond to climate change, for example, often talked about building compact, low-carbon cities. Density was seen as a good thing for social cohesion or for economic innovation. We heard more and more about building compact cities, about the possibility of the 15-minute walkable city, which we hear a lot more about these days, and the need for greater densification, even as cities continue to sprawl and suburbanize and to spread out territorially across the world. And so now it's just over a year since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, And all of that is up in the air, or at least it seems to be up in the air. We've seen a vast de-densification of the urban world caused by the virus, followed by all kinds of new architectures and regulations for managing density in order to reduce infection. New social anxieties have become attached to density. There are heated debates, for example, about the presence of different kinds of crowds in the city. And at the same time, there's an increasing longing, in some quarters at least, for lost densities, for the buzz and the bustle of people thrown together in the city. City authorities worry about the future of city centre economies, transport managers struggle to plan for an uncertain future, analysts speculate about new patterns of labour distribution and changing residential geographies in and beyond the city. So density, as we've come to know it, seems to be at stake in ways that it has scarcely been before. So to explore how COVID-19 is impacting density, we have four people, as Marcus was saying, who come at density from quite different perspectives and contexts, ranging from South Africa and Taiwan to Canada and the UK, and have also been working in all kinds of other cities globally from different positions. So I want to start then by asking about density itself. How should we understand it? And why is it important both to how we understand cities and to how we understand this pandemic? And perhaps I could go to Margot Rubin in Johannesburg just to start us off, please, Margot.
Sure, thanks, Colin. I think we need to think about density in a whole lot of different ways. I mean, we can think about the kind of classical densities in terms of the numbers of buildings per square kilometer. We can think of occupancy densities in terms of the numbers of people. But I think what we also have to think about is the relationship between the ideas of density and intensity. And this changes the view slightly, because we need to think about the numbers of people and the numbers of activities which go on in the same places at the same time, which kind of give a conviviality, which give a bustle, which give a sense of energy in a number of places, the kind of agglomeration that goes on. So we need to think about density in relation to that. We need to think about it in terms of density and transit and the number of cars, the number of taxis, the number of rickshaws, the number of movable vehicles that go around and around the city, around a place. All of these things combine to create different senses of how we understand density, and all of them are related to each other. So I don't think we can just think about density in the kind of classical way of just thinking about, oh, you know, it's the number of people in a room or the number of people in a household. I think we need to think about all of these different activities and how they coalesce to construct our different visions and our different understandings of density within our cities. I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Margot. That's an excellent start. Could we move over to Lucia? And perhaps, Lucia, you come from obviously a policy context in London, but also with one foot in academic work with your PhD. What for you is density, and why do you think it matters for how we come to grips with the city and the pandemic?
So from my perspective in London and from a planning policy perspective, so I think there has been an interesting shift. So until quite recently, density was in policy terms understood as a quantitative parameter. So it was linked to infrastructure accessibility, and the level of accessibility would determine the appropriate density level for a given site. And so a couple of years ago, and after some years of debate in different forums, there was a shift at a metropolitan level. So density changed from being a quantitative parameter to a qualitative parameter. So the thresholds, maximum thresholds for density were removed, and there was a shift to optimization of density, in fact, maximization of density across sites, but also this sort of qualitative understanding of the importance of how do we design high density environments. So in that context, I joined Tower Hamlets. So for those of you who are not familiar with Tower Hamlets, it's an inner borough within London, and is the densest borough in London and the UK. And in certain areas, for example, the south of Canary Wharf has some of the highest densities in Europe, and depending on how you measure it, in the world. But it's also home for different communities with really great levels of inequality. So the council at that point needed to sort of develop a piece of work to understand better what density means. So how can it be assessed and how can we deliver good quality high density environments? So until that point, new residential schemes were assessed in terms of townscape impact or environmental impact in the surroundings of these developments. But there was very little knowledge about how different levels of density impacted the quality of life of residents, and also the challenges that it created for people working and managing these environments. And when we looked at empirical data and research, we found very little available information. So at that point, we undertook one of the largest and most comprehensive post-occupancy evaluations. So through surveys and interviews with residents, building managers. And in the light of this work, I think we have learned that density should be conceived, as Margot was saying, in a much more complex way. So it's not about only measuring density as dwellings per hectare in new developments, but it's also about how it relates with the quality. So how different forms of density sort of impact from energy consumption to waste production, quality of life of residents, not only from the point of sickness that in the pandemic has been highlighted, but also general well-being. And so we have to understand density in a multi-scalar way. And that needs to be incorporated into policy.
Thank you, Lucia. I'm really struck by both yourself, Lucia, and Margot, beginning by noting this shift away from density as a number to this qualitative understanding of density operating across actually a really kind of wide range of different urban spheres that you talked about, different urban domains that you talked about, both of you. Roger, I think, can I go to you, Roger, and ask you, I mean, I want to hear how you conceive density in relation to work you're doing, but I'm also curious as to what you think this more, Lucia used this phrase, more complex version of density linked to quality of life, what that might open up for how we understand the pandemic, that more expansive notion of density. But perhaps you could begin just by saying something about your own approach to density and how you see that as mattering for how we understand the pandemic and cities.
Yes, thanks. Hello, everyone. I find it difficult to even talk about density in a conversation like this now, as if we could say something really new about it. It is, as you said in your introduction, it is tied to the very understanding of what cities are. And since we have been talking about cities in modern social science for 150 years now, it has always been there, and it's a concept that has been fundamental to how we talk about urban life in cities. And what Lucia and Margot just said added immensely to that lexicon of what it means. But it is difficult to because density has been so ingrained in both popular and scholarly understandings of what it might be, to break through to a new conversation. And I'm glad we're having this conversation today to perhaps move that a little bit. And since we're talking today overall about a politics of density, I thought I'd throw in an angle that is really important in many contexts, and probably as much in South Africa, in the UK, as much as in Canada, by my understanding, which is the fact that density is always related to desires around land. When you hear somebody speak about density in the media, or if somebody writes a book about cities and the word density comes in as a concept that wants to explain something, it's often used in a very emphatic way, like as if density itself said something about the city, that it's either good or it's bad. And, we all know, which way that can go, that Manhattan is a good kind of density versus, some informal settlement somewhere else may not be a good kind of density. So these concepts are always linked to how land is used. So when today this emphatic use is predominant, it is often linked to ecological ideas about how to live a better life on this planet, which is which is threatened by climate change, or it is linked to getting us closer together to make us more diverse and functioning urban communities. But at the bottom of these sort of emphatic understandings of density as almost solutions in themselves are desires about who profits from the land that is being used to make the users of that land dense. And that is really something that when we talk about the politics of density that we need to look at more intensely, because these interests that are linked to densifying the city or de-densifying the city, those interests are often not the same that those people have that want to build a better world. And that is where I want to leave it first, and we can come back to some aspects of that later.
That's great. Thanks, Roger. That's fascinating. And actually, I'm really struck by some of the connections with what you were saying. And I know, Lucia, the work that you've been doing in London is such an intensive politics of land, and indeed a politics of air, right? And the kind of speculative element of that in relation to the construction of densities. But I want to move to Hongying. And Hongying, I know that your work, a lot of your work in places like Hong Kong and indeed in Taiwan previously in your PhD research was precisely about the politics of land and air and the kind of the real estate economy. Just thinking about what Roger was just saying there about the centrality of land, how we understand density, you're in Taiwan at the moment. Does that resonate with your own approach to density, or would you want to highlight other issues in, when you think about density and its relation to the pandemic in cities?
Yeah. Thanks, Colin. And also, I'm kind of struck by how Margot and Lucia was opening about their observation of how urban density is being understood through intensification and more kind of social dimension. In Taiwan, come back to your question, I think there is some kind of weird phenomenon that has been observed that people thought that pandemic would deeply hit the economy, but we did, and especially in Taiwan now, there are also rising kind of geopolitical tension between Taiwan and China, the cross-strait relationship. But then we didn't find any sign of seeing the like housing affordability being improved. That being said, that is the housing price was kind of staggering high and also keep increasing. And this is until now still a puzzle. And since I haven't really studied into this question, so I'll just leave it here. And then changing to the other dimension that we observed in our research project on urban density in Taipei so far. And because in the density project, we can pay special attention to how the public understand, perceive, and cope with the urban density during the pandemic. So I have observed that people's perception of urban density are widely, there are some commonalities about how people didn't really feel so much about urban density being changed, but they are variously shaped upon their own life experience, which is often a mixed product of class, gender, and cultural experiences. So insofar I've observed there are two major operational logics and perhaps levers behind the convenience of high density cities. So one is more kind of about class, and the other is more about the density of collaboration. So that's the kind of social dimension, social quality of urban density. And in Taiwan, I think the kind of collaboration density is more being highlighted in the current patterns of governance. So it actually more emphasized on how sometimes a more kind of subdivided, intensive, and sometimes fragmented division of labor, and that restructured the layers of care as a form of communal density. So the importance of, like, for example, understanding the mass perception of density and its impact on the pandemic, I think it is helping to prevent those policy designs that could actually exacerbate the situation. One example I want to raise, actually I also prepare a picture that I'm not really sure whether the audience can, the listeners can see. One picture that I provided is that there's a community venue in Taipei, which set up a walkthrough UVC thermometer and disinfection gates to sustain the daily activities for the local elderly. And this is one of the most vulnerable communities in southern Taipei, with the majority population, they are socioeconomic low-income groups, immigrants and elderly. And it was a community which hit hard by the 2003 SARS, as it was really just next to the hospital, which was imposed partial lockdown. And they learned from the past lessons. And the community leader, they decided that this community venue will continue to provide their elderly care service every day, even during the peak of the pandemic in Taiwan since last March. And this decision was actually contradict to the government instruction, but then they thought the borough warden was thinking that instead of letting people just go in their own way and not knowing their trajectories, it is better to keep the service running and keep everyone to see each other, so then he would not lose the control to what kind of risk that people are exposing themselves to. So I think this example is slightly extraordinary, but because it really depends on the resources available for the local communities and the patterns of local transmission. But I think this actually brings up another dimension about rethinking density as a form of socially kind of stitching, the way of care to each other. So I'll just stop here.
Yeah, great. That's excellent. Thank you, Hongyu. It's fascinating, a whole range of issues there about how the pandemic is impacting multiple spheres. And the picture that you mentioned will be put up on Instagram along with some other images that go with the podcast. So there'll be pictures there for people to see if you're curious to see the, what Hongyu was referring to there. I know that Margot wanted to come in specifically, going back to Roger's point about politics and land use in the context of the pandemic. So Margot, perhaps you could come in there and pick up that point, and maybe if there's a connection there to Hongying as well, you could raise that as well.
Sure, will do. Thanks so much. I mean, I think that the point that Roger was raising around density and land use is absolutely key. But I think that and for us, what's happened, and it's been really interesting in the politics of it. You know, in South Africa, what's been happening is that there's been a very strong anti-informal settlement sentiment that's been going on for a number of years, despite policy quite to the contrary. And what's happened during the pandemic has been this real emphasis on de-densifying informal settlements, because they've been seen very clearly as being the kind of bad density that everyone refers to, overcrowded, poor services, et cetera, et cetera. But that's really been cover. I mean, the politics behind that has been a more normative perspective around how land should be used and what it should be used for. And there's a very clear sense that land should not be used for informal settlements, that it deprives people of ownership, that it's not within the kind of capitalist regime of land ownership and land transfer. But it's been this really interesting kind of relationship between the Department of Human Settlements using the pandemic as a kind of cover to de-densify. But really what is lying underneath it is a politics of how land should be used and an understanding of how land should be valued. And that's got nothing to do with use value and everything to do with the old kind of traditional notions of exchange value. So,
yeah. And I think that, you know, there's a long history of that kind of opportunism in moments of crisis that political power has used in the past that we could probably all refer to, and certainly other cases during the pandemic. So that point is very well made, Margot. I was going to move on, but I can see that Lucia also wants to come in on a specific point. So Lucia, perhaps you can just follow up on this quickly, then we'll move on to our next part of the discussion.
Yes. I just wanted to follow up on a comment from Roger and yourself on, you know, density has been a concept that we have been using for a long time. And I think at some point, and what happened at a metropolitan level, that they thought density was not complex enough to sort of like capture all what that was happening at the city level. And so they decided to, you know, get rid of that policy. But I think you know, we need to make it more complex in terms of the policy, in policy making, but it's fundamental because it's the tool, so the decision making and sort of governance of density has become, at a local authority level at least, a battle. So there are lots of interest in terms of what happens in different sites. And I think density is one of the only elements that local authorities have at the moment to, I was going to say fight, but negotiate with developers. And I think, you know, it's fundamental to have a density as part of policy to also control land value. So now that the density concept has been removed from the London plan, for example, now, we have seen the prices of land rocketing. So there is very little control of land value. And then that sort of ends up in increasing really high densities. So yeah, I just wanted to touch on that.
So the widening conversation about different aspects of density, questions of quality of life, environmental impact and so on, becomes a means through which local authorities can actually push back against certain types of private development, for example.
Yeah, definitely. I think both. So from a qualitative perspective, it's important to have that understanding of density, but also we need to keep the quantitative element of density to sort of establish those sort of conversations with other stakeholders who operate in the city. Yeah.
Sure. And as you say, the limits have been listed in London with all kinds of consequences. Great. We've started to talk here about housing and land in particular, but other issues have also been raised in the conversation so far. We've talked about transit, governance, labour, the politics of care, for example, that Hong Yung mentioned. If I could just push you guys a bit further to think about the impact of the pandemic in relation to different kinds of densities. I mean, are you saying that there are particular, is it your view that there are particular areas of the city, whether it's housing or transport or something else, which has been particularly profoundly impacted by COVID in relation to density? So can we just kind of, what would you name as the key arena of density that's been hit by the pandemic in particular? And perhaps just to start us off on that point, we might go to Hong Ying, who I know that you had your hand up, Hong Ying, as well in relation to the previous conversation. So perhaps I'll move over to you to start us off on that.
Okay, so I'll just kind of pick up from where we left on like land value and perhaps density and during the pandemic, because I think Taipei, where the example of Taipei can offer here is kind of slightly extraordinary, as I think there are quite a lot of this kind of speculative capital. They were eyeing on how this is kind of taking up the chance of Taipei being less affected, so then the capital just kind of pull in to buy lots of that kind of real estate and push this kind of development of housing prices. But on the other hand, I would like to share a recent experience of talking to the housing activists based in Manila, because I think they offer a kind of contrasting example, especially about how density is being reshaped during the pandemic. Where I'm really sorry about this, the background
no
noise.
Problem.
I'll just
no
probably
problem.
Leave it, yeah, wait until it fade away. Okay, so just coming back. Recently I was talking with a housing activist from Manila, and he kind of shared about how the Manila government, actually in the Philippines, certain kind of density, and especially the transit, the kind of mass transit system that were largely run by rickshaw was being blamed for making the kind of transit density unsafe for many people. So instead of investing more in like public health directly, the government used this as an excuse to justify their expansion in local transport infrastructure in the name of transit-oriented development. And I think this is also something probably echoes what Margot and other authors for their newly edited published book on densifying the city. They talk about this kind of transit-oriented development that is kind of leading the city investment and also the kind of density expansion pattern. And in the Philippines, they don't really understand is that they're more kind of frontline and critical workers, their health and their vaccination need to be implemented first. But instead of putting investment into the public health sector directly, the government actually choose to put more money into the transit infrastructure. This is kind of there's some underlying logic about how it actually used the pandemic has been utilized as an excuse to draw more real estate investment rather than securing the public health. So I'll just stop here.
That's fascinating. Thanks, Hung Ying. And Roger, I wonder if we could come to you on this point. We're hearing a couple of cases here, aren't we, about the sort of political opportunism of governments furthering pre-existing agendas, but using the pandemic as a sort of dressing for that. I don't know if that's something you'd like to specifically comment on, but also just to ask your thoughts on this larger question of sort of the particular kinds of densities that have been especially impacted by COVID.
Yeah, thanks. I just to go back to that last round of conversations on your first question, there is a very good example of exactly sort of these pre-existing agendas that have now come to the fore in behind the fog of the pandemic. I live in Toronto, which is in the province of Ontario in Canada, and province of Ontario is governed by a very conservative government, which came in 2 years ago on a very strongly neoliberal agenda of increasing the economic prowess of the province and opening up the province for business and getting rid of what they call red tape. And now they have come through on many of those behind the fog of the pandemic, many of those agenda items. And one of them is really typical for the discussion we've had about the politics of density and land use, which is they have used a tool that is called a ministerial zoning order, which is pretty much what it says it is. It is and basically a directive given by the minister, by the government itself, of how land should be used. And they have intervened in a variety of places in the province now to increase land value and land value capture in areas where there should be environmental assessments, where there should be more discussion about how the land should be used. And they have explicitly used density as an argument and to say we need to create housing, affordable housing for people. We need to do this in order to create better densities. Those are the arguments that are being made on this kind of platform that has now been created in this context. But I want to move on to your second question, which is about density and how it has been changed and how we have begun to change in looking at density since the beginning of the pandemic. And to go back again, just briefly, without, you know, I mean, this is something that most of us know intuitively, but the modern idea of density is linked to modern societies, modern cities, and it goes back to notions that Karl Marx, for example, developed around the factory. That is the factory was the equivalent of what Engels described in Manchester in the living quarters of the proletariat. The factory is a massing of people and machines and in a particular building. So that these densities were created out of what previous were agricultural societies. So it's linked to industrialization, to modernization in that way, but it's also linked, just want to throw this in without being, you know, really entitled to speak about that in any knowledgeable way, but it's also linked to the plantation as a way in which densities in world capitalism were created. Now, fast forward to where we are now, the modern institutions that came with these kind of ideas, the factory, workers' housing, and the plantation, what we have left from that type of density is the long-term care home, the hospital, the school, the prison. These are the institutions of modern society that have become now the hotspots of the pandemic. These are the places where people died. These are the places that had to be particularly regulated, cared for. So this is a very interesting moment that those kinds of institutions, many of them were brought in at the last pandemic, like hospitals were built after the Spanish flu of 1918. Public health institutions were created. Those are the kinds of institutions that have now become the focal points of the current debate about densities. And so in that case, densities killed. And of course, to go back to the workers' housing in the factories and the plantation, look where we still have outbreaks, which is in the Amazon warehouses and in the slaughterhouses, where often there are immigrant workers employed. So it all comes around to the same kind of mix of what was previously referred to as of use values and exchange values that capitalism just reproduces spatially and continues to do so. And the pandemic has both revealed the crevices in these models, but it also has, of course, reinforced the kinds of dynamics that those models carried with them all these years.
I think that notion, Roger, that the kind of inbuilt historical inequalities and vulnerabilities are sort of playing themselves out in the current vulnerabilities connected to density and the pandemic is a really incredibly insightful historical reading of the pandemic. And I'd love to know, Margot, looking at the context of South Africa, where of course the history of apartheid and the legacies of that continues to the present day, to what extent those kind of histories may have rolled into the playing out of the impact of the pandemic in South Africa. Perhaps you can say something about that, or if you prefer to talk more generally about the impact of the pandemic on density, what particular issues would you want to flag up there?
I think they're actually joined. I don't think we can separate them at all. I think the historicity. Yeah. Of impact is directly linked to kind of what's going on. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I was thinking as Roger was speaking about the fact that two of the biggest sectors that have been hit by the pandemic have been the informal traders and the paratransit taxi industry. But in completely different ways. So the informal traders have largely been removed from city street corners. They haven't been allowed to trade. They've effectively been completely removed out of public spaces. And, the reason for that is once again, this kind of historical system where informal traders don't have a great deal of voice within the participatory governance model of South Africa. They're largely a very apolitical, not very powerful lobby within the kind of context of South Africa. And this is historical. They've been demobilized, depoliticized, and consistently made vulnerable for 70, 80, 100 years in the Johannesburg context, and probably even longer in the Cape Town kind of context. So that's been one set of actors who've not been able to earn a living properly for well over a year. And that's had huge implications for their quality of life and so on. Conversely, the transit sector, the paratransit sector, which basically moves about 80% of people on a daily basis around South Africa, made up of these minibus taxis, as we call them, they were told to reduce numbers. They were told that they had to obey certain rules. There were all kinds of regulations that were put in place. But the taxi industry, which has largely been run as a mafia, in South Africa, pushed back and said, no, we will not obey any of these rules. We're not interested in your legislation. We need to make a living. It's difficult enough considering people are in lockdown and we're doing a very small amount of travel compared to what we were doing before. And they simply pushed back. And what it did is it revealed in very stark relief how powerful the taxi industry is and how historically powerful they have been in the South African context. I mean, they and also their very strong links into the party politics politics of the country, into having links into politicians and government officials. And so what we've seen is this very differential impact of the pandemic on two entirely different sectors, and that the differential has been based partly on historical connections of what's happened and who's had political power and who's had connections to political power and who hasn't. And that's been made manifest really on the landscape of the South African cities.
Excellent. Thank you, Margot. Lucia, perhaps I could ask you, looking at the context of Tower Hamlets and the borough and the work that's been going on around the pandemic, where do you see the particular impact of the pandemic on densities in the area?
Thank you. So from the point of view of Tower Hamlets, but also London, I think we have seen the pandemic impacting at different scales. So I just want to start, for example, with the neighborhood level. So we have seen, I mean, given the pandemic, that people are living more locally. And so there has been an increase or exacerbating tensions around the access to open space. So I'm sure you have all read about in the news about what is happening with the low traffic neighborhoods. So I think as Roger was mentioning about how the pandemic has been utilized by neoliberal agendas to push certain interests, also I think on the progressive side, the local authorities are using the pandemic to push, for example, for the prioritization of pedestrians and cyclists as opposed to cars. And this has happened in London, but also in Barcelona. And this has given, has created a lots of tensions, and is a very political debate that I think brings back the right to the city. So who is meant to be using public space? For example, it has highlighted also the lack of play space for children and opportunities for children to move independently in the city. So that's one scale where I think the pandemic has impacted quite strongly, but also at the home level. So in the work that we have done, we have seen how certain functions that, as also Roger was mentioning, following the Industrial Revolution, were externalized, such as work or care, has been now pushed back to the home. And this has created, again, tensions in London in particular, given the fact that the flat sizes are the smallest in average across Europe. And then I think I just wanted to mention that in light of the research we have done, there is also another area that usually gets overseen. So I think if from the home perspective, I think functions that were previously externalized during the Industrial Revolution, such as work and care, have been now internalized. And that has created tensions in the home. In London in particular, given the fact that the flats are the smallest in average compared to other European countries. But also I think I wanted to mention another area where the pandemic has had a great impact and that usually gets overseen, which is communal spaces or domestic commons. So courtyards, circulation spaces. And I think we have seen in the light of our work that these places are key to mitigate some of the issues in terms of inequality. But usually those spaces are forgotten, are very poorly designed, and therefore fail to meet their intended functions. So I think these three areas are quite key in thinking about the pandemic and the where of the entity.
Thank you, Lucia, that's fascinating. I'm really interested in some of the issues that have come up around the geographies of density here in terms of the impact of the pandemic. So I would love to ask you all about the kind of the where of density, sort of geographies of density in relation to the pandemic, because we've heard about informal traders, taxi drivers, rickshaw drivers in places like Manila, but also in South Africa. We've heard about care homes, prisons, hostels in North America, but elsewhere, particular kinds of geographies which have been particularly vulnerable because of the inequalities in the cities that we're all looking at in different ways. So I suppose my question is, how do we understand the geographies of density in the context of this pandemic moment, given that a lot of the public debate is really about, for example, new patterns of working from home, people buying houses in the suburbs or outside of the city. You know, the geographies of the kind of public conversation tends to be about this kind of center periphery relationship in the city. But what we're talking about here, what you guys are saying, is much more kind of a nuanced notion of different groups and spaces being particularly impacted. So I don't know, perhaps Roger, you could begin here with some reflections on this question of the where of density in the pandemic moment.
Yeah, I think that the main point here is what Lucia just mentioned, which is the domesticization, is that a word? To make domestic again functions that were public or that were outside of the home. And that really has created a sort of an inversion of processes that had just prior to the pandemic gone on. In Toronto, for example, we've had what they call a condo boom, a condominium boom. Those of you who have seen images of Vancouver or Toronto over the last 20 years, you've seen huge glass boxes being built, mostly on the waterfront. Tens of thousands of new, very small often, condominiums were built and increased the built density and brought population back into the center of the city. Those condominiums are very small. They're like boxes in the sky, and they have become now a matter of like a contentious space in many ways, because they were built in an urban environment that provided restaurants and fun places and spaces, entertainment places outside of the condominium in walking distance. So mostly young people, this was linked to the millennials coming back to the city. Young people could live in these condos in fairly small places in the center of the city, because life went on somewhere else. It didn't necessarily go on in the living space in the condominium, but that has now changed. So there is a push from that kind of built density to other kinds of densities, as the people who inhabit these places now have been looking for more space where they can combine residential purposes, care, and work in one living space. So this has led to the assumption that in this region, in the Toronto region, as in other regions in the world, there has been sort of a tendency to look for more spacious quarters elsewhere. And often the idea is that that elsewhere is in the suburban ring, where there is also a different kind of housing form available, which is the single family home, the ground related single family home. So the push for more space is also apparently a push for a different form of building, but that different form of building, of course, also symbolizes a different form, at least in the North American context, a different form of sociality, a different idea about family, what family is, what families should do, what a house is for. It's a place where children are raised. There's all these fairly conservative ideas about what life is like and what urban life is like have pushed back into the picture. But it isn't as simple as that. This is just one way in which the geography of density has moved, because the people who are now moving out of the city, if they are moving out of the city, and if that is by their choice, they often look for a different kind of a suburban experience as they move. They want to have things that they are used to when they live in the city. They don't want to go back to sort of the classical 1960s idea of what a suburb is. They want fun in the suburbs. They want cycling infrastructure in the suburbs. They want perhaps to have a cafe at a street corner. So we will have to see how that goes. So this is one way in which a geography has changed. And you can see that in the development, again, coming back to my very first point, in the development of real estate prices. This is costly, and it has driven up real estate prices in those more peripheral areas. We are now talking in Toronto, the real estate industry is talking about a suburban housing bubble, a real estate bubble, that the housing prices are completely inflated because of that. I just want to say, this is just the one side, and it's linked to this idea that housing is a question of choice, and people make the choice to move somewhere else away from the pandemic. But there is another one, of course, which is that you know, the majority of people can't move anywhere. They are, you know, trapped by, you know, having children in a particular school or having a job in a particular location. And they don't have the means to buy a house in the suburbs. So hundreds of thousands of people will remain in those kinds of dense inner city environments. And those dense inner city, when I say inner city, they can also be inner suburban. In those environments, they are linked to particular other densities that have nothing to do with residential. They are linked to a trip on the bus with many, many other people who go to the same kinds of minimum wage jobs in the service industry in other parts of the city. So when we talk about choice and the change of geography, the change of desires to move out of the city, let's not forget that there is another type of densities that are more landlocked in a way. They are more locked into the location where they are. And the pandemic has exacerbated the grievances in those communities without giving those people a reasonable way to change their lives.
Thank you, Roger. And I'm struck by some of the similarities with some of the work that Lucia is doing in London in relation to local authority, and perhaps we can come back to that, Lucia. But just before we do come to you, Hongying, I mean, I'm very interested, Hongying, in how this is playing out in Taipei, which of course is a city which has been kind of heralded globally as being relatively successful in the management of COVID. To what extent is the pandemic shifting the geographies of density in the city, when it's had actually a relatively a less severe hit on urban life than it has in other places such as Canada and the UK?
Yeah, so while the kind of successful stories are more very much circulated in the international media, I would probably like to bring up another more kind of reflexive aspect about rethinking urban densities and about the where's in plural form of density. So perhaps the most direct impacts of the changing density imagery in policy planning in Taiwan and also in a lot of countries is the idea of citizenship and global mobility, and especially the government in imaginary about what would be the risk about global traveling. And it highlights the remapping of citizenship priorities in terms of prioritizing their own nationals, the nationality, and the country's epidemiological situation. So in Taiwan, for example, Taiwan society has long relied on migrant workers from Southeast Asia as the major workforce for the elderly care. And recently, there are several kind of policy change about this because of the kind of relative relational pandemic situation across Southeast Asia. So, for example, with increase in the number of infected migrant workers, incoming migrant workers into Taiwan, for example, Indonesia, the Taiwanese government suspended introduction of Indonesian migrant workers at the end of last year. What does it mean is that while there is a really serious shortage of these critical workers at the care industry in Taiwan, the government encouraged the Human Resource Agency to seek for more kind of healthy potential labor force from other countries that were less affected by the pandemic. So here it shows a hidden logic of this, that there is a kind of intra-country labor mobility that is built upon the idea of importing healthy labor, healthy body, rather than consuming the local public health resource. And what behind this example is that it actually suggests the cutoff of certain existing manners and relationships of migrant domestic workers and their agencies and the families they've been working with. And one striking issue about, I think this is an example about showing how the restructuring across the urban economic, labor, social, and developmental geographies for years to come, because this is something that we see how the uneven geography emerge, that it poses a question about how and why would people who are infected and may have more vulnerable family members to take care of they need to take the risk to travel abroad to serve other families. They were way less affected by the pandemic.
Thank you, Hongying. And that raises a really vital set of issues we haven't discussed so far around migration. So thanks for adding that to the discussion. Margot, do you want to come in here?
Yes, thanks very much. You know, it occurs to me that the situation here is quite different. And because trying to understand the geography of the pandemic and its epidemiology, I can never say that word, is based on data. And here what we have is a situation where data is not in short supply, but is centrally controlled by a number of government institutions. And so the data that's been used is incredibly suspect, because once again, it seems to be tied to a series of political ends. So we know from colleagues in one of the organizations we work very closely with that there was a claim that there was massive infection rates in some of the informal settlements in the southern parts of Johannesburg. Now, as it turned out, this was completely untrue. And once again, what it was about was a desire to redo and de-densify that entire area. And so it's very hard to tell the geography of the disease of the pandemic in South African cities, because, well, not in South African cities, in cities in Gauteng and Johannesburg and surrounds, because of how data has been controlled. And what we think we know is that the assumption that informal settlements would be locales of massive infection because of their overcrowding and their poor services, all the bad density stuff, we think is that's actually not been the case. And rather what we've seen is has been outbreaks in the more middle income areas and in areas where there's been an ignoring of the lockdown regulations, people not wearing masks, people not for hand washing, those kinds of things. So for us, the geography of it is very, very difficult to work out and is deeply linked into these political processes, which make claims about where the infections have happened and how they've happened very suspect. And that kind of brings us full circle to what Roger was saying earlier about the politics of these situations.
Absolutely. And so many cases that I'm sure we're all familiar with now internationally of certain types of typically lower income neighborhoods being blamed for infection in given cities without actually the data to support it. And lots of data showing that the links between density and the spread of COVID are actually really tenuous, and that density plays a relatively small role, if at all, in the spread of the virus. And certainly in lower income communities, research in India, for example, and elsewhere. So there's all sorts of debates going on internationally about that. And I think that's a vital point, Margot. Thanks for raising it. Lucia, can we move to you now on this question?
Yes. So I guess, there are some things. So basically, starting with what you were mentioning about blaming density for levels of infection. So I think what the pandemic has shown is how the difference between density on the paper, so what we call a high density development, and overcrowding. So basically areas of Tower Hamlets and London where, you know, we could consider those areas as a medium density or even low density are actually a place where homes are overcrowded and therefore the level of infections are much higher. And those new high density developments where we have a high percentage of private homes, we don't see those levels of infection. So that shows that probably there is no overcrowding. And so I think that's an important point of the word of density. But I think also that the pandemic has brought a new debates in London, at least. So in the draft London plan, there was an intention at the beginning to try and level off the densification. So they were sort of proposing to have more density located in suburban or more suburban local authorities as opposed to inner local London boroughs. This in the final draft was removed. So again, the levels of intensification and densification has focused on inner local authorities. So I think the pandemic might bring that back to the table. So they need to spread out and densities across, you know, central and more suburban areas. And I think, I'll leave it there. Well, I just wanted to mention, sorry, that I'm focusing on the residential aspect, but also, for example, for Tower Hamlets in terms of business and financial centers, Canary Wharf has been greatly impacted, but I think it's still quite soon to know what is the impact and whether there would be some level of recovery or reconversion into other uses.
Thank you, Lucia. We're getting towards the end of our conversation, and I want to leave some time for people to offer some final reflections as we wrap up. But before we do get to that conversation, stepping back from the range of issues we've discussed here, we've covered an enormous amount of ground in terms of the issues and the places that have come up. What would be your reflections on the politics of all of this for the city, the politics of this encounter between COVID and density for the city? I was struck in the conversation, for example, when Lucia mentioned the rights to the city and building a kind of urban commons. Hongying, you talked about politics of migration. Roger talked about the need to pay attention to the historical geographies and politics at play in the contemporary unfolding of the pandemic. And Margot, you've talked about the politics of data, the politics of pre-existing political agendas, right? So we've already started to grapple with this, but perhaps I could come back to each of you now and just ask you to reflect on what you think as the kind of politics of these developments that we've been discussing over the last period. Hongying, I could ask you to get us started on this.
Okay, I'll probably try to reflect on two points. They're quite kind of immature, but just kind of something that I come up with. One is about more how this pandemic actually changing the way that we think of density to, for example, the relation, how we live in the relational world. And one of the approach that we are focused in the project is that we also look at the kind of devices, the relational interfaces, not only about the physical spaces that people need to share or like, for example, overcrowded home, but also about what sort of interfaces are being imagined and functioned. So one thing I'm looking at, even staying in a relatively bubbled situation in Taiwan, what I'm studying is how the bubble of routine density is being sustained against all kinds of challenges, and how what sort of measure, why would people follow? And so one thing, for example, about the surgical mask is that it seems for many, it seems like surgical masks master their popularity as a sign of pandemic preparedness. But looking into the logic of using the surgical mask, I think there's a lesson, a collective lesson for people here, is that people quickly adopt it, not because it's a personal protection equipment. Is that, on the contrary, it's not about protecting yourself. Masks are don't, not really to protect where from getting infected, but to knowing how oneself, one's own behavior, from speaking to spitting to coughing, could actually affect others' health, and especially unknown others. So this is something that we are kind of reshuffling our understanding about how one could relate to each other. And there's other more kind of substantial examples of such devices, such as the housing infrastructures, from the window ventilation system, pipeline systems, elevator, etc., could become the kind of interface that people started to be aware that, especially in the vertical community, that lots of people who got infected, not because of physical direct encounter, but because of this kind of invisible transmission routes. So this is one of the dimension that I want to raise. The other thing that I want to point out is about how the pandemic also taught a lesson, a very challenging lesson and ongoing, about how to cope with multiple fears. They are all kind of encompassing at once. So when thinking about, for example, the political protest emerged during the pandemic over the past 1 year, for example, what we see in the mass protests sparked in Hong Kong and Burma over past months, 2 years. the kind of political intensity that brought by the rise of authoritarian and military regimes has pushed people to make very difficult decision to choose between political risk and public health risk. And I think there, and also in many places, they are also suffering from the fear of staying in hunger and other situation. So they are definitely, just come back to the initial point that I raised about there are two different type of levers that we utilize the density. One is perhaps about the class, the other is about coordination. It's the decision-making moment and how we shift from more kind of differentiating the class and the level of suffering to more the kind of collaborating and coordinating density.
Thank you, Hongying. There's so much in there. And I think that you're absolutely right that there is going to be, isn't there, all kinds of legacies around the politics of the encounter, all those spaces of interface that you mentioned, the politics of crowding and specific kinds of crowds, and how people perceive and experience those kinds of crowded situations as well. There's a kind of open set of politics there, which I think is absolutely pivotal for the next few years. Could we perhaps move to Lucia here to take us up a bit further from there?
Yeah, and so I think from the point of view of my point of view, from a local authority perspective, I think the pandemic is showing a better appreciation and higher value of health and the importance of city design and radical inequalities in terms of air quality, overcrowding, and access to open space from the public perception. So I think we can expect more pressure and scrutiny from residents and media on the quality of new developments and whether they meet the needs of communities. And I think also in terms of the impact of the pandemic moving forward, I just wanted to raise here the how the pandemic and density is highlighting or highlighting the importance of the public sector and the more proactive sort of planning. So I think we have been operating under a more sort of reactive attitude from local authorities in regards to density. And I think the pandemic has shown that, you know, the public sector and local authorities have to be proactive. We cannot rely on developers to deliver good designs within the red lines. I think we need to be more proactive and be more comprehensive in the way we design cities and we ensemble different parts of the city together to make sure that we are delivering, you know, good quality open space and we are mitigating against some of the of these issues. And I think also from a local authority perspective, we are saying that it's important to integrate better different areas of policy. So I think, for example, in my local authority, there is a new team, so trying to work across different departments, because I think what is showing is that health is closely related with the built environment, but also with education, care. So I think that's also a push moving forward. And finally, I think more transparency. I think in terms of how the city is built and the governance of densification, we have been operating under quite sort of obscure and behind the door sort of discussions. And I think now there is a clear understanding that we need to be more transparent and we need to, you know, bring forward better ways of for the public to engage and sort of make sure that we are understanding what the impact of what we are doing is in the communities. So better data gathering, a better sort of evidence to support new policies. So I think that's all I want to
say. Thank you, Lucia. Yeah, it's kind of really fascinating to think about the kind of impacts there that the pandemic might have in terms of local authorities rethinking their own relationship, their own work on density, rethinking their relationship to urban health and so on. There's some really fascinating issues that I'd love to pick up more. Could we move to Margot?
Sure. You know, it's been interesting to watch what's unfolded. When the pandemic first began, our president, Cyril Ramaphosa, stood up and he gave these incredibly inspiring, reassuring addresses to the nation. They became known as family meetings, kind of colloquially. and at these family meetings for at least the initial stages of lockdown, there was the sense that our government was handling the situation incredibly well, that the members of the primary party, the African National Congress, were all aligned, and that, you know, for at least the first 3-4 months, there was really this very strong sense that South Africa and South African politicians and politics were really pulling together, and most people were very impressed. And then it all started to fall apart. And we started to see what was revealed was as the noise lessened and as the lockdowns went on, it was kind of like watching the bones being pulled back off a carcass, and we were really left with seeing the skeleton of what was happening underneath, and looking at it and seeing how these issues of corruption which have been plaguing South Africa, how deep-seated they are, seeing the kind of schisms within the majority party, how divided and how divisive that party is at the moment, and how little support the president has. We were able to see the silos in which the various government departments are working, and even that they were supposed to be pulling together, there really were issues around coordination, collaboration. And so, you know, over the period of the pandemic, it's been kind of witnessing, in a way, these deep-seated, these really entrenched problematics. And some of them have become just even more embedded over time. But it's been really about a politics of reveal, a politics of being able to look behind the noise and some of the kinds of rhetoric that we're often presented with, to see just to really understand the state of our government and our governance in South African cities. And that's been, for many of us, deeply disappointing.
Thank you, Margot. Roger.
Yeah, there's so many points raised by my colleagues here that I'd like to engage with, because they really confirm a lot and make me think about what's happening here in Toronto and Canada and other places I've observed. But I'd like to float a concept that's been going through my mind, thinking about the politics of density lately, which is this idea of rewilding of the city, a rewilding in so many ways, because the modern city that has created the densities in which we now live, that modern city was created by order and planning, urban planning, particularly in the hygienic city of the 20th century, wanted to create an order that actually took the dirt and the animals and everything natural away from urban living in many ways, and sort of hedged everything in the bacterial understanding of what life and what threatens life had to be managed in that way. But in the pandemic now, we've seen a certain rewilding there of course, the anecdotal aspects of actual, you know, animals moving back into the city, not just the dolphins into the waters of Venice. But also, you know, here in Toronto now, you have coyote attacks on pets, and you have all manner of wild animals back into the city. But that's not really what I mean by rewilding only. What I observe is also that people just break the rules everywhere, which is maybe more noticeable in a stuck-up Victorian city like Toronto used to be, and it is not anymore. And last night I took a walk, as I do most nights, through the parks here, and I noticed that there were many fires going everywhere. This would have been unimaginable. People sitting in social distance around fires drinking, which is also unimaginable in a city which doesn't allow public consumption of alcohol. These kinds of things are now going on. People on the beach just hanging out, and it's not that warm here. It's just the beginning of spring. So the city has really changed. It has been rewilded in so many ways. And I think there will be a new politics around that, because it'll be difficult to take that back from the people. It'll be difficult to hedge people back in. There will be fights over the use of public space, just even to walk in the park, not on the path, but everywhere, because you try to avoid people. You walk everywhere in the park. You walk across the lawns. Those kinds of things have now become common practice in the pandemic, and they will there will be a politics about whether that should be maintained going forward. Now the problem here is again that while society has come into its own and claimed its own spaces and has been backing up a lot of the pandemic measures that the state brought in, and society has realized itself and as urban society and has found new ways to be in the city, the state has also found new ways of being in the city, and that is through surveillance technologies of trying to control people's movements and trying to control particular people's movements. So the homeless people who are now everywhere and put pitching tents everywhere in the city are constantly under threat from the local state and the provincial state as they are being pushed in and out of certain spaces and are being managed in ways that are not democratic and not in any way liberating. That is, of course, linked to what we haven't talked about at all, which needs particular attention, is these new technologies of surveillance that have been evolving in the pandemic that have now become public technologies, technologies that we have gotten used to live with. And the question is, what will be the politics of the use of those urban technologies as we move forward? And I expect a lot of debate around that, and not just in those arcane spaces where people debate the smart city. I think that is something that we will have to debate across the field of urban studies.
Thank you, Roger. That's fascinating. As ever, you've given us more to think with, rewilding the politics of new surveillance technologies and forms of control. Vital, and as you say, we haven't had a chance even to get to those issues, but they're fascinating and important. We're at a point where we need to wrap things up, and it's been fascinating to hear your reflections on these very fast changing circumstances. I just want to give you guys an opportunity, if there's any final thoughts or reflections that you want to throw in, perhaps issues you haven't had a chance to mention in the last couple of minutes here. So it's sort of open to see if anyone's got any final thoughts. Lucia, I don't know if you want to, if you have anything you'd like to add at this point?
I think, you know, it's a very sort of broad debate, and I think we have touched onto many different issues. I just wanted to say that, in my opinion, the pandemic has not sort of like created new issues, but has highlighted, you know, historic issues happening in the city. And I think also the pandemic is a moment of acceleration in history. So I think for me, and from the perspective of, you know, working for a local authority and also in academia, it's a great opportunity. So as Roger was mentioning about rewiring the different elements within the urban context, you know, opportunities to reclaim the right to the city and for whom are we, you know, planning and designing the city. But I think it's also a great opportunity that because it has bring some level of consensus. So when we were, you know, prior to the pandemic discussing certain issues with developers or other actors, there was quite a lot of rejection or opposition, you know, like to some of the issues that we were mentioning. And I think as we saw the pandemic unfolding and through public consultation, we have seen that now there is a greater level of consensus about between different actors. I think I'm being unoptimistic here, but I want to believe that, you know, the pandemic is sort of like given the opportunity to do things better moving forward. And I think also it's a great opportunity for the local authorities and the public sector to be empowered. So as Mariana Matsukatsu has been sort of arguing for, you know, the public sector has demonstrated how they can be effective and you know, deliver as opposed to what the assumptions were in the past about, you know, how sort of reactive or slow were the public sector in dealing with issues. And I think just a final call on, I think the pandemic has also pointed to the need of better collaboration between the academia and policy making and, or the more pragmatic sort of world. And I see there a huge sort of opportunity and chance for different people working in different sectors to come together and debate. So that's all.
Excellent, thank you, Lucia. Hongying, a final thought for you in a moment or so. Do you share Lucia's optimism, or what's your thinking?
Yeah, I think we are all still in the very much ongoing process of learning how to handle and how to adjust ourselves amid this kind of contingent development of the pandemic, waves of pandemic. And I just want to probably the last thought, rather than thought, is probably in an advertisement that I forgot to mention the source that I cited about Manila. And I would like to probably take up the opportunity to advertise specifically an upcoming series of Global South conversation in Radical Housing Journal, which is where my Manila source come from. And it may came out, it should come up in the end of May this year. And because there is a series of ongoing conversations specifically about housing activists from different parts of the Global South sharing their reflections on how the pandemic reshaped local housing markets and forms of resistance. And again, thank you so much for this great opportunity.
Thank you, Hongying, for your great reflections and thoughts on the issues. And I'll leave it with yourself, Roger, for a final, just to finish us off.
Well, thank you very much. I don't want to say anything that looks like a final word on anything, but I am very, very concerned for us as progressive urbanists, very concerned in terms of the defense of transit. I think it is going to be, there will be a ruthless attack of the usual forces of the automobile industry that is now shifting to electric cars, and but also others who are now emboldened to defund existing transit or future transit projects. And I think that particularly in the larger cities where we live, but also in the smaller towns where more people move now, that is absolutely critical that we maintain a functioning networked system of rail-based but also bus-based transit to move people around who have no access to private automobiles. That is various age groups, people of various disabilities, but also people, of course, who are socially disadvantaged. It is really important that we maintain a conversation about affordable, networked, satisfactory transit connectivity in our cities, as the numbers have dropped to 10 or 20% through the pandemic. And so the densities may fall in cities, but we need transit anyway to not leave people behind in islands of deserts of transit injustice. And I think that must be on everybody's progressive agenda as we're moving forward. And thanks so much for this wonderful conversation.
Absolutely, I totally agree. And it's a debate here in Newcastle about public transport. And I know it's a global debate as well that we all need to be paying more attention to in the years to come. Okay, that's fascinating. Thanks, Roger. Thanks to all of you, to Margot, to Hongying, to Lucia, and to yourself, Roger, for a really fascinating talk. We've covered an enormous amount of ground and given, I think, hopefully listeners a lot to think about in relation to density and its futures in the city. So thanks very much, everybody.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website, urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.